Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. For the second and third segment today, I am pleased to have James Corbett of the Corbett Report, the lead writer for the International Forecaster, joining me for those two segments. And it's always a pleasure to spend time with James. He's so informative. Reminds me of Bob Chapman. And of course, he is the lead writer. Bob chose him to be the lead writer for the International Forecaster. But because of his location, that is pre-recorded. So we did touch briefly on the G7 and some of the other things that are going on. And news is changing so rapidly in today's world, we might have to do something about that. Maybe, instead of waiting for Friday to air his program, to do it a little bit sooner. But anyway, it was a great interview with James Corbett, so please stay tuned. I am live right now. It is Friday, June 8th, 2018, and I am solo, all by my little itsy bitsy lonesome here. So, but I think I could do that for 20 minutes. And, for the past couple of days, I've just been receiving so many wonderful calls from the listeners telling me how long they've been listening. Because again, there's lots of folks out there who listen and, they're not in the position to purchase gold and silver. And, but it's still a joy to hear from so many of you. It does give you a shot in the arm to keep going. Because there are days and weeks and perhaps even months where it's just like, you think, oh, I just can't do this another day. And after 23 years, almost 24 years, it's, you need those shots in the arm. So thank you very much. And let's get started right away with the market report. We had gold did edge up a little bit today ahead of the G7 meeting, but the dollar strength put a little bit of a cap to the gain. And let's go ahead and see what those caps were today. $1,299.50. They just won't allow it to go over $1,300, will they? It's up $1.70 at $1,299.50. Silver was up 6 cents today at $16.83. Platinum was up $4 at $908. Palladium was holding at $1,016. And the U.S. dollar was up, but not that much, but the trend has been higher, up 0.11 at 93.54. Crude oil was down 0.31 at 65.64. And, of course, the paper markets were, again, positive. They're not going to let that go down. We got the Fed meeting next week, and you have the big meeting with going on in Singapore with President Kim Jong-un. And we have the Dow up 75 points today at 25,316. The NASDAQ was up 10 at 7,645. And the S&P was up 8, 2,779. 10-year yield 2.94%. A little weakness in the euro. Futures contract for gold, though, did hit 1303. And let's see, European Asian markets were, soft overnight. Hong Kong was down almost 2%. Let's go take a peek at that fear and greed emotion. Let's see, it's still up there at the 62. So people of this country, or at least for that emotion index, are greedy. They're more concerned about being greedy than they are with any fear. And even though we have seen fear in that level and that index, there hasn't. Absolutely no panic whatsoever. So a lot of confidence, even though they might be a little fearful, there's a lot of confidence that government, Wall Street, will not allow it to go back to the levels that it did during the Great Recession, and that's the biggest mistake that you can make. And whether we have a downfall in, in the stock market today, tomorrow, next week, we still have inflation that will affect your children and your grandchildren for years to come. They're the ones that will be facing, if not sooner, we might be. We might still be that generation. But your children, your grandchildren are the ones that will definitely have to pay the price for the reckless spending and growth of government of the United States and around the world. Excuse me. So we had gold prices increase a little bit, and it gained a little bit of support, as I mentioned, but it was hemmed in by the rise in the dollar. And this is the narrowest weekly range in more than a decade, and that goes back to 2007. Yes, I do have to take a little swallow there. Please forgive me, ladies and gentlemen. It's just I took a breath, and bigger than I should have. Don't you love live radio? And Todd isn't even playing any music for me today, but and I don't have Pastor Butcher or Alan, Dave Allen, to join me in. So I'm going to touch a little. I'm going to touch briefly on the G7 meeting. Hopefully, I can recover here. As I mentioned, James and I discussed it during our interview. And again, you had the top U.S. allies. They scrambled today to keep a group of seven nations summit from veering off the track, as we had the President Donald Trump vowed to deal with unfair trade practices by Canada and the European Union. He really went up there with a big stick, and you know, I'm kind of proud of him for that. You know, we're going to deal with the unfair trade practices. If you look at what Canada and Mexico, the European Union, all of them have been doing to us for many, many decades, we have to change it, and they understand, and it's going to happen, he said. He also made an interesting point. He said that Russia should be attending the summit. An idea that was unlikely to gain much traction at this meeting with the groups of Canada, the United States, Japan, Britain, Italy, France, and Germany. The EU is also attending. And if everyone remembers, Russia was part of this group. It was called the G8, but they were suspended back in 2014 because of its annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. Trump said that Russia should be readmitted. But even Moscow seemed to reject that suggestion. But Trump is right about one thing. Russia should be at this meeting today, because what happened on the other side of the world, President Xi Jinping gave China's first friendship medal to Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. As the neighboring giants touted their close ties amid diplomatic and economic challenges from the U.S., China's highest honor was bestowed. This is their highest honor, and they give it to foreigners who make outstanding contribution to the country. Russia has helped China with their modernization drive and helped maintain world peace, Xi Jinping had said. This medal of friendship represents the Chinese people's lofty respect for the President Putin and symbolizes the profound friendship between China and Russia. So here you have the most powerful Russian and Chinese leaders in decades. They have forged closer ties, and I think it would be a better thing had Putin joined the G7 meeting instead of making that relationship between China even closer. So so President Trump is correct. It would have been better to have Russia at this G7 meeting than in China accepting this award. So very interesting. Those two countries are forging together. The three most powerful central banks are going to convene next week. You have the U.S. Federal Reserve. They're setting the pace in a retreat from the era of easy money. What do you think is going to happen when they are setting this pace with the three most powerful central banks? These three meetings within 36 hours of each other are set to conclude with the Fed raising interest rates, the European Central Bank potentially fleshing out its plan to cease buying bonds, but the Bank of Japan is going to maintain its massive stimulus program. Again, here we see you have the three most powerful central banks coming together, coordinated, synchronized on this monetary policy, making these announcements all together. We've seen it before. We're going to see it again. But it just confirms how they all work together in order to keep this global monetary system from collapsing as yet, or are we pulling back from this? What happens without easy money? What happens when the stimulus no longer exists? You know, the markets, the world markets, these economies, that's all they're based on. They're just based on stimulus, easy money. And what happens after that? Ben Bernanke says that the U.S. economy faces a wily coyote moment. He talks about 2020. I think it's going to be much sooner than 2020. But they're using 2020 because he's talking about the tax cuts, the $1.5 trillion in personal and corporate tax cuts, and a $300 billion increase in federal spending that was signed by President Trump makes the Fed's job more difficult all around, he says, because it's coming at a time of very low U.S. unemployment. We didn't need the stimulus, or did we? He's arguing that the stimulus came at the very wrong moment. He says the economy is already at full employment. He says the stimulus is going to hit the economy in a big way this year and next year, and then in 2020, the wily coyote is going to go off the cliff. And I think most of us and most of the listeners, I think we've been around long enough to know who Wile E. Coyote is when he goes off the cliff. And that's what he was referencing, our U.S. economy. I don't know if these tax cuts will make it to 2020 before we go off the cliff. If you go back to Ronald Reagan, his tax cuts before he went into the Great Recession and he ended spending 126, the debt went up 126%. It was a year and a half. I don't know if this is based on, previous tax cuts and the stimulus. When you see it work its way into the economy, it lasts a year and a half to 2 years, or if he actually has some other information that allowed him to make that prediction. So, we'll see. That's the election year. So, again, it could happen at a very poor time, or perhaps this is what it's all geared for. Maybe they do want the economy to hold out until 2020. Because in reality, I don't know if it's really about the economy anymore. I do think it is. But I think this time around in 2020, there might be some, it's still going to be immigration. It's still going to be a lot of the other issues that made President Trump popular and get him elected as president. I think everybody knows my feelings about drugs. I'm not a fan of legalization. I don't think we've seen what truly happens. And I get there's reports around the world in various places that shows, countries are actually better. I think we have a moral responsibility there's got to be something else that we can do instead of legalizing everything. In one moment, you hear from the president that the opioids, those who sell them, should get the death penalty. And then the next minute, he's ready to support a bipartisan effort in Congress to ease the U.S. ban on marijuana. He was asked about a proposal today that would reshape the nation's approach to pot, and he said he would probably end up supporting that. The federal ban has created a conflict with, there are 24 states now. I didn't realize there were that many. 24 states that have legalized marijuana in some form. Now, medical marijuana, yes, I agree with that. And I think it should be available to those who need it. I think it's very important. And I think some of those 24 states are just for that, for medical purposes. The legislation would ensure states have the right to determine the best approach to marijuana within their borders. Some U.S. restrictions would remain, including recreational sales to people under 21. You know, the Republican Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado is co-sponsoring. Of course he is. And I'll tell you what, these are big tax revenue folks, ladies and gentlemen. You know, these politicians, they'd pass anything if it would bring revenue to their states so they can continue to spend and cover up their gross negligence in managing their states. So they'll do anything to get more revenue, whether it's right or whether it's wrong. And so that's what it's really all about. So when asked about the measure, Trump told reporters in Washington that we're looking at it, but he will probably end up supporting that. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188 for discount gold and silver trading. Please make sure that you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter. And I came across, you know, there was an article out by CNBC, and it talks about healthcare costs in retirement. Fidelity Investment estimates that a healthy 65-year-old couple retiring this year is going to need almost $300,000 to cover their healthcare costs in retirement. Financial advisors suggest consumers think about those expenses as part of their overall retirement plan rather than a standalone number. It's these healthcare costs. Does anybody think that's, you know, high? I mean, there's a new analysis. It shows that for a man, he's going to need $133,000, a woman $147,000, and a woman would need more because usually men will die a little sooner. This includes premiums, cost-sharing provisions, out-of-pocket costs associated with Medicare Parts A, B, and D. But the figures do not include other health expenses such as over-the-counter medications, dental services, long-term care, do not factor in any employment-provided retiree health coverage. So you're actually paying a whole lot more. You're probably, with all that, you're probably paying almost $400,000 for two. And it's like, how do people do it when they can't even have $1,000 in an account for an emergency? And we know Social Security is bankrupt. Medicare is bankrupt. They're only going to be lasting, we're told, 10 years, so that really means 5 years. So ladies and gentlemen, please prepare. Make sure you have something that's going to offset those costs of inflationary numbers as you head into retirement. And we are heading into a break now. I want to thank you for joining me today, and stay tuned for James Corbett. We will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule the world.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I am pleased to welcome James Corbett to the program today. And as you know, James is the founder and editor of The Corbett Report and also the lead editorial writer for The International Forecaster, which is the weekly e-newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. James, how are you?
I am peachy keen today.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, it's hard to believe. It's been 7 years, I believe, on Monday that we lost Bob Chapman to pancreatic cancer. And rarely a day passes to which my listeners, clients, friends here at Discount Gold and Silver, where he is just fondly remembered. Everyone misses him so, and so it's hard to believe that time has just swept right by, that it has been as long as it has been, and because it seems like it was just yesterday that he was here with us. So I just wanted to make that notation, you being the lead writer for Bob, and we miss him.
You know, absolutely, and I absolutely refuse to believe it's been 7 years. Has it been 7 years already?
Unless I miscalculated, which is a possibility.
I think it's 6 years, but at any rate, it has been absolutely, yes, incredible that he asked me to take over as the lead editorial writer of The Forecaster before he passed away. It was absolutely flummoxing to me. It was incredible that he had the faith in me to do that. And so it's not something I take lightly. Obviously, the decades that he put into building up the International Forecaster and all of his work into what it became, and the tireless efforts into his 70s and still doing radio programs dozens of times a week and always on top of the news. He was really a one in a million kind of guy and absolutely missed.
He really was. Did you meet him?
Never met him once in person. No, we had many conversations, but never once in real life.
I happened to see one of his keeping his radio schedules. I shared this on the radio the other day. I mean, his radio schedules were just unbelievable. I mean, it was just a piece of paper, and there had to have been the tiniest little print that you could see. I mean, you could barely see it, you know. And now I know why he wore those big glasses. So he could see his own print. But, yes, a wonderful man, wonderful family. And, have a very special place in my heart and everyone else's heart. You know, I believe the world has truly gone mad. That's the only rational explanation for everything. And here in the States, we're listening to both sides of the political spectrum, you know, from the deep states in a panic, from the bizarre behaviors of Rudy Giuliani. And, you know, I'm not sure my views of the deep state as the same manner as like the major networks, well, especially Fox might portray Donald Trump's enemies. I mean, I do believe there is a group with an agenda. But I think the Comeys, the Muellers, and the rest of them, they're only the pawns and only scratching the surface. Would you like to comment on the quote-unquote deep state?
Yes, well, that's a very good point that you make, because deep state has only entered the mainstream political lexicon in the last year or two, as I'm sure everyone out there knows, but it has been around for quite a bit longer than that now. It's going back decades at this point, going to researchers like Peter Dale Scott, who pioneered the term and the idea when looking at, as he extensively has done in his writing, looking at, for example, the JFK assassination or 9/11. He talked about deep state and deep phenomena going on in the highest levels of government. And in that context, I think it's a very fleshed out and interesting idea. But in, of course, what becomes the McDonald soundbite kind of style at which everything is just thrown at you on the 24/7 news cycle these days, the term deep state has been watered down to the point of almost meaninglessness at this point. I mean, it just refers to some of the, a few of the old guard or some of the people who hang on through administration after administration. But it is, as you say, a much deeper, if you'll forgive the adjective there, a deeper phenomenon. It's a more important thing that's going on than just a few of these Mueller's or people like that, Mueller. It's encapsulated in something that's going on this weekend that I imagine some of your audience might have heard about, which is the Bilderberg Conference, which of course
I was just going to ask you about that. Yes,
absolutely. Well, Turin, Italy, this weekend is going to be the scene of the. Let's do a quick calculation. It's going to be about this. Well, we're getting on to the 70th conference. I don't know if we're there yet, but at any rate, somewhere around there. And this year, they're going to be talking about populism in Europe. They're going to be talking about inequality. They're going to be talking about Russia. They're going to be talking about the post-truth world and other things, at least according to the official agenda. You know, believe it as far as you can throw it. But obviously, these are the things that preoccupy the minds of the people in the real deep state. And when we're talking about the real deep state, we're talking about more like the people who attend a Bilderberg conference, the CEOs of major international corporations, the heads of many foreign governments, very high-ranking officials, ex-CIA chief, people like Henry Kissinger. These types of people tend to be at least the super gophers of whoever is really pulling the strings. And I'm not going to get into that. That's above my pay grade. But at any rate, there are people who are much higher up in the hierarchy, as the real hierarchy that exists, than these people that are kind of being thrown around as the deep state by the mainstream press these days. And I think it's unfortunate that this topic has become so diluted from its real meaning, because when you really look at it, there really is a driving force behind many of these major events that happen, but it's not the people that are being dangled in front of us in the puppet show that is politics.
Are the Bilderbergers, or is the true deep state, are they in panic? Are they comfortable with the scenarios that are going on here and around the world? Are they threatened?
Well, first of all, I would like I think that the premise of that question might be based on the idea of an all-powerful ruling oligarchy that can do everything and does everything, and everything that happens is their doing. And that is kind of the simplistic way that sometimes we think of it, even myself and others, when we just kind of gloss over it. Yeah, the deep state, they control everything. I think it's much more that there are competing power structures and competing elements within the deep state. Maybe we can't say the deep state, because maybe there are multiple deep states and they overlap in different ways. G. Edward Griffin gave a presentation that I always recommend to people, where he was talking about the concept of rings within rings, that there are these vast rings of people who are associated in different groups and connections and conferences and things that may or may not have any idea of what the ring of people kind of closer into the center of power are doing. And those people might not know what's going on a little bit closer into the center of power. So I think there are overlapping and interlocking systems of control, and they compete with each other. So I'm not sure there is a singular agenda and there is a singular response to what's happening right now, that the deep state is panicking per se. I think that, again, might simplify it too much to the point where it's diluted. But So taking it from that perspective, I'm not sure there is a plan which is being threatened here. There are plans that could be threatened, but I'm not sure there is a singular plan. And so it's always a question of which way the powers that shouldn't be, the various interlocking forces, which way they want to try to direct change, because change is always happening and it's always moving forward. It's just a question of which direction do we go in with it, this or that change. So there is a sense in which these populist movements and things absolutely can be co-opted and diverted and put into part of the larger plan. So we always have to think, I think, from that strategic framework where, yeah, there's a lot of things that are happening that maybe if there was some magic controller who controlled literally every event in the world wouldn't want to happen. But if it's happening, well, how can we direct it this way, or how can we direct it that way? I think that's the way that the people, for example, attending Bilderberg tend to think of world events, is how can we use this this momentum to our advantage? And that, conversely, that's exactly how we, the people who aren't in those positions of power with billions of dollars and banks and whatever at our control, that's the way we need to be thinking about this. Change is happening. We are in a forward momentum. But how do we direct that? And how do we make it so it doesn't end up in this consolidation of control in the hands of this power-mad elite?
But as we see the wealth of these, for lack of a better term right now, the elite, doesn't that give them some sort of an extra thumb over us? I mean, doesn't that allow them to truly control things more so than they ever have before?
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of the snowball rolling downhill. I mean, it's not just that they're rich and more rich and powerful. It's that discrepancy between their riches and power is growing and growing and growing. So that, absolutely, people in those positions do have vastly more resources to throw at these things than the people. But there are a couple of things to note about that. And one of them is that I always try to bring it back to the perspective that, yes, absolutely, they spend untold, unthinkable amounts of money and time and energy trying to direct society this way and that, and to brainwash people and to keep them in their bubbles and to keep them fighting with each other, divide and conquer, and all of these things. But I think what that actually points to, in a way that sometimes gets glossed over, is the fact that it still is the average people out there. It's really us and our opinions and which way we are motivated to go that is still the underlying determining factor. That's why they spend so much time propagandizing and trying to make us believe that or this, or to throw us off, or to stage a deep state event in order to make everyone panic. It's because our reactions still are the important piece of this puzzle. There are billions of us, and only, you know, however many it is, you know, if you want to count the super gophers, if you take, David Rothkopf's formulation, he called them the super class, and he said there is about 8,000 people on the planet who have the ability to influence international events that are supranational. And if you want to take that formulation, then there are 8,000 of them. There are billions of us. We really do have the power, but we have to consciously know and wield that power, and that's exactly why I'm here, and I'm imagining it's a large part of the reason that you're there doing what you do.
Absolutely. It was interesting. I saw a short interview right before the show. It was Robert Kennedy Jr. was being interviewed by, I don't know, one of the Fox analysts. I think it was Tucker Carlson. I just saw the end of it. He's releasing a new book, but he was upset with about the president not releasing more information on the assassination of his uncle. And it was really, it piqued my interest because, you know, he's talking about, what he had seen, and about the, you know, how the CIA was connected to the assassination and so forth. And he really had some great information, and that really doesn't even, you know, match up to what we were talking about, except, you know, here's this other little group that the, you know, history was changed, and, it's difficult to truly get to the truth, to the matter. So, I will get the title of that book. Didn't have a chance to see what the title of the book was, but it was really an interesting interview with Robert Kennedy Jr.
And yeah, I don't know the book off the top of my head either, but I do know that, yes, RFK Jr. has been talking a lot more openly about some of these things recently, including not just the assassination of his uncle, but also his father. And some, yes. Again, for I don't know how much this has been openly questioned by the family itself, but at any rate, it is now being openly brought into the question. Who killed RFK? Was it Sirhan Sirhan, or is that a patsy? And anyone who's actually looked into the matter know that there is ample evidence that RFK was not assassinated by Sirhan Sirhan, that he was hit by multiple bullets, including some from close range at the back, where Sirhan Sirhan was not standing. So there are, I mean, just as there are questions about, well, not just questions, but really impossibilities with regards to the official account of the JFK assassination, it's also there with the RFK assassination.
What do you think would happen if the truth ever came out?
It's a very good question, because we're now over half a century out,
yeah.
And certainly I would imagine most of the main players in whatever assassination plots existed are now long gone, and many of the people who were in the thick of it are at the very least extremely advancing in age, and so I think there is a point at which these types of things could ultimately come out in one way or another and not completely upend society. And that's actually kind of a horrible thought, because anyone who studies history knows there are always conspiracies and plots and power plays and intrigues and all sorts of things going on. And we understand this and we know this from all eras of history going back thousands of years. And we know about, the assassination of Caesar and things like this. I mean, it's happened over and over and over again in history. But for some reason, no, that doesn't happen in our era. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Oh, you must be crazy. So there's some line, there's like almost a statute of limitations, but not in a legal sense, in a psychological sense, for people to accept, oh yeah, that happened, but that was in the past, and that doesn't affect us now. And I don't know if we're crossing over that line with JFK, but we must be getting close to it.
Well, I hope they do it soon. As I'm still here, I would like to see what happens. But anyway, something interesting, I saw the report tonight that your prime minister is scheduled to meet with President Trump tomorrow. This trip was hastily arranged, and so the trip sort of suggests that the Japanese leaders might have some concerns about Trump's administration, to the approach to North Korea, as well as trade and, of course, the U.S. and China relations. There's concerns that, that Japan might be just totally eliminated with these agreements. So they're concerned about the nuclear part of it. There's a growing fear of decoupling, concerns that the United States might not uphold its extended commitments to Japan and South Korea. Are these true concerns for Japan?
There are, I think, a couple of main issues on the table here, and as you say, I think the steel tariffs and the other things that are starting, the protectionist trade wars, are very much front and center in terms of Abe's maybe interest in getting Trump's ear and to finding out, in deeper detail where this is going. But I think, as you say, obviously the North Korean summit is going to be an incredibly important part of any conversation that takes place. And one of the issues that I find interesting is that, in fact, it's not actually clear how much access Japan is going to have to the real inside information about what is actually happening at the summit, to the point where it is now being reported that Japan is sending representatives to Singapore to hopefully get some updates while they're there about what is happening. It may be the case where the Japanese government is actually getting updates about the conference the same way we all are from the news.
Well, let's hold those thoughts. We're heading into a break, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with James Corbett, and we'll be right back right after these few short messages.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% 10% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Again, you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom. Going into the break, we were talking about the
North Korea summit.
So yes, we were talking about the North Korea summit and how Japan might feel a little abandoned because them not being welcomed, perhaps, too.
Well, the entire summit is just so seems cobbled together in so many ways that I don't think many people, maybe not even the U.S. and North Korea, have any real clear understanding of how this is going to take place and what's going to happen and how people are going to find out about what's happening. So, as I said before the break, Abe I can't remember which minister, the chief cabinet secretary of Japan, Yoshihide Suga, is going to dispatch diplomats to Singapore to try to get the latest updates. So it's a pretty interesting development, the way this is all going together, and who knows what information is going to come out when. But I think Japan primarily has two points that are going to be extremely important. One is that in an earlier summit between Trump and Abe a couple of months ago, they had some sort of commitment or expressed some sort of commitment to the idea that sanctions against North Korea will not be lifted unless and until there is clear steps towards denuclearization. And that has to be, you know, the first part of this. North Korea has to really take some significant steps towards that before the tensions are let up or whatever. So that was Japan's position. That's not so clear that is the U.S. position anymore. Perhaps the summit is more about the summit than it is about denuclearization at this point. The other issue, which is one that I'm imagining is not even on the radar for most Americans, is the abductee issue, which is in the late 70s, early 80s, there were 17 Japanese citizens that were abducted from Japan, usually from coastal areas, literally jumped, taken, put into a boat, and taken over to North Korea, where some of them were apparently used as Japanese teachers to teach Korean spies how to speak Japanese, and others were just abducted for their identity, so were presumed killed right away. At any rate, those 17 citizens, that's been a big sticking point in any sort of possibility of relations between Japan and North Korea for many, many decades now, and it's still an issue that's raised here quite regularly in the press and amongst the public. So Abe has asked Trump to address this issue at the summit. There's also South Korean citizens that have been abducted, so this is kind of a multilateral concern, but it's not at all clear that I think this is a pressing concern on the Trump side, so I'm not sure that will be addressed.
Do you think Dennis Rodman is going to be a factor?
I suppose he could be. I mean, this is not something I ever expected to discuss, getting into geopolitics and things. But yeah, it may be that Dennis Rodman might actually be a factor in this. I mean, I don't know. I think I'm just going to break out the popcorn, essentially, for this summit, because who knows if it's going to happen, what's going to happen, how we're going to find out about what happened. I think it's just a show at this point.
Yes. Who knows? Dennis Rodman might win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Who knows? Well, you know, this weekend we had the G7 meeting going on in Canada, and there's also an anti-G7 getting underway in China, and that is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. No Westerners are allowed in this club, and the dominant members are, of course, Russia and China. There's, I believe you mentioned there was up to 8 members currently in this anti-G7 group. But would you like to comment on both the G7 meeting in Canada and this Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Yes. Well, the latter one first. For people who have never heard of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it officially formed in 2001 out of the Shanghai Five that was meeting from 1996. And as you say, China and Russia are the kind of the nucleus of that. But it now includes Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and just last year, India and Pakistan. India,
yes,
and Pakistan were added as members together, which is interesting because obviously India and Pakistan have their issues, but here they are together in this Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which I've always heard framed as maybe like a counter-NATO type of organization. It's not explicitly a military compact like NATO, but it involves military cooperation exercises and things along those lines. So it is, again, interesting that India and Pakistan are together as full-fledged members in this group right now. But it also, of course, covers not just geopolitical, but economic concerns and economic ties. So it's often been compared kind of loosely to some sort of counter-NATO, maybe as a counter-G7. Maybe that's an even better way of framing it, because it is more about, I think, about economic ties and things like that. But always some interesting things that come out of those BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meetings. And I did write about last year's summit in the Forecaster last year. So I will be writing about this and the G7 and Bilderberg and the North Korean summit in the Forecaster this weekend. So I hope people will stay tuned for that. Oh, and as to address the G7, it's interesting that was it a year ago, a couple of years ago, when Russia was still in the G8 at that time, Putin was very much sidelined, eating by himself and things like this, very much castigated and thrown out from the group before he was officially thrown out from the group. Now there are people speculating, well, could it be a G6 plus one, as in Trump being castigated because of the recent brouhaha around trade and the tariffs and all of this, which is causing real problems, I think, with some of these relationships. I mean, obviously, we've seen Trudeau fire back and say that Canada is going to slap on dollar-for-dollar sanctions against U.S. goods in response for the sanctioning of aluminum and other products from Canada, and Europe is getting quite angry about some of these things and taking the U.S. to the World Trade Organization to sue them, and obviously Japan has its issues with some of these protectionist policies. So there's a lot of friction. It's going to be, I think, maybe a bit more sparky kind of G7 than we're used to, when usually they're about putting on at least a cooperative front for the cameras. It may not be that way this year.
Well, you know, isn't the WTO basically worthless? I mean, I've seen lawsuits go through before, nothing really happens, and, you know, this and that happens, but it's really, they have allowed China, to abuse.
It's very true. I mean, the worst thing that could possibly happen is if the World Trade Organization actually grew real teeth and really did become a major player, because I think that would be, globalization arriving in the worst possible form. And I've written in the Forecaster before about some of the ways that there are some pretty disturbing trends towards companies, for example, being able to sue governments if they are seen to be harming their profit or profitability and things like this, that can really open up some horrible loopholes that most people wouldn't want, but obviously the corporations do want. So obviously, if there is a corporatocracy, they very much want the WTO to have more teeth and to be more able to step in and dictate to countries what they can and cannot do. And so obviously, I think from that perspective, we do not want the World Trade Organization to become effective. It would be like the UN becoming effective. That would actually be scary, more scary than the fact that it is a toothless monster. So at any rate, I think that's the way that it's treated. But it does, I mean, there are decisions that come down. There are punitive measures that happen. And at any rate, at the very last resort, it could kick off a trade war. And that's what the WTO is theoretically supposed to design to prevent, in the same way, I guess, the League of Nations was designed to prevent world war. Oops, I mean, it really could eventuate from this type of move.
Well, wasn't that what the Trans-Pacific Partnership was? I mean, one of the dangerous parts of that was the legalities, the being able to do the sue one another in a global court and so forth. I mean, probably not as, you know, I'm not saying it as deep as it should
well,
be.
Well, no,
that
but there
was,
are,
to me,
there
that was the biggest problem with that.
There were very scary clauses in that TPP when it eventually got leaked out to the public. And I did write about that in the Forecaster at the time, talking about some of those clauses and what they really mean in real speak, not the legalese gobbledygook that they try to hide everything in. And there were some very scary ones, including some, as you say, some of those things about corporations being able to sue governments and basically increasing the power of corporations to around the world to essentially impose the laxest of all not just regulations but ways of dealing with any country. They'll just shop around and find the kind of the best from their perspective for the bottom line and impose that on the rest of the TPP area. So it's a good thing that the TPP was scrapped, at least in the form that it was being planned, however it might go forward in the future without the U.S. And similarly, I think the World Trade Organization raises a lot of the same sort of issues.
I just want to go back briefly to the G7 and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. With us, if there's issues with trade with the G7 and you're seeing this, the CSO, and these countries, do you think is this a way for them to accelerate their plans to settle trade with each other in other currencies, bypassing the dollar? And what type of impact is that going to have? The more these other groups become bigger and stronger.
Absolutely, yes. I've been writing about this for years now, and I've been trying to hammer it home recently because it's accelerating now that it seems every action that's being taken on the international stage right now by the U.S. and its Pax Americana allies is almost seems like it is designed to create, if not to incentivize, the creation of these counter institutions and counter frameworks and regional agreements and trading relationships, and to foster those types of counter organizations like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and others. Obviously, the more that the U.S. pushes away its allies, the more they're going to turn to each other, and the more, for example, Iran sanctions or the sanctions against Russia or trade wars against China, of course, I mean, the absolutely 100% predictable outcome of those types of actions is these countries are going to start banding together more. And that's exactly the point of the New Silk Road and the One Belt, One Road initiative coming out of China, is to try to bring together a lot of these nations together in more tightly consolidated and with laid down actual physical infrastructure, joining them up, putting them together in regional frameworks and groupings and strengthening economic ties so that they can trade more amongst each other. And of course, we've seen all the thousand different paper cuts, if you will, that's cutting into the U.S. dollar hegemony. Of course, none of those paper cuts is even significant on the bigger scheme of things by itself, but they start to add up, and we can imagine the balance of trade settlement starting to change, and the U.S. dollar, which is almost universally used in international trade, is starting to get chipped away at. And China specifically is making sure that there's a lot of different ways that people can now start to use the yuan. It still is not really a currency that's very usable. There are two currencies. There's the international one and the kind of the domestic one, and the domestic one is pegged in a floating peg with the U.S. dollar. So there's a lot of things that disincentivize international trade being settled in the yuan, but they're starting to open that up. And things like the, as we talked about before, the oil futures contracts denominated in yuan, things like that are really starting to change the calculus for some of these nations. And now that Iran is being sanctioned again, what are they going to do? Well, hey, maybe they can trade with China directly in yuan for oil. And there are some significant changes that are happening. And as I say, I think this is being actively incentivized and fostered by the moves that are being made on the other side of the chessboard right now.
And, you know, with Iran and the sanctions, isn't there discussions that some of these trades would be done with gold?
Yes, although, as you pointed out, some of the sanctions themselves are against gold, gold settlement and gold trade with Iran. So I think that maybe they've already foreseen that. In fact, one of the largest and most elaborate sanctions evasion schemes in the history of the world took place during the last round of Iranian sanctions, where Turkey was doing the gold for a gas deal with Iran. And that is still being unraveled. I think just earlier this year, it was some people were just convicted in their part in that sanctions evasion scheme in court. So it's still being unraveled, and things are still going on about that. But yes, clearly one way or another, certainly that oil and gas is going to find some way out towards some very hungry markets, including, of course, China, the largest oil importer in the world at this point. It's going to happen. It's just a question of which way they facilitate that trade.
Well, what if the EU doesn't go along and bypasses the sanctions that the U.S. puts on Iran? What if they don't pull out of the agreement?
Yes, that's something I've been writing about recently, too. It's not at all clear that they're going to just blanket go along with this. But, of course, the U.S. is also thinking about that, so they're threatening to sanction companies that do go around the sanctions directly. So it's becoming quite a mess, and I think the G7 and others will be interesting just to see how these relations start to pan out, because obviously there's some big changes coming on the geopolitical table.
Well, we're out of time, James. We could go on for another hour. I do enjoy spending these two segments with you, and I look forward to doing it again in 2 weeks. So thank you once again, ladies and gentlemen. 1-800-375-4188. Be safe, good night, and God bless.